Welcome to Behind the Podium, a podcast series brought to you by Fusion Learning Partners that lets you hear what speakers are saying before or after the podium mic is turned on. Join me, your host, Jasper Appleton, to find out what makes these speakers tick and find out new insights on topics that matter to you on each episode of Behind the Podium.
Welcome back to the Behind the Podium podcast. I'm your host, Jasper Appleton. With me today is Director of Customer Engineering for the SLED team at Google, as well as one of our 2023 government IT keynote speakers, Mr. Christopher Hine. Thank you for coming on the show today.
Excited to be here.
Thank you. So on this podcast, we really like to dive into the background of our guests and what made them decide to pursue the passions that they're currently in. Can you tell the listeners about how you started your journey in IT and how you made your way towards advocating for the public sector?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a long and sordid tale, so forgive me if it goes too much. But, you know, in terms of my journey on it, really, you know, go back to the days of just being one of those kids growing up with a Commodore 64 playing what were video games of the time and thinking to myself, I'm going to make these one day. And, you know, got my my bachelor's degree and master's degree in computer science. And as I went into that, what I really found was more so than game design, which was not actually my thing. What I found to be really fascinating about it was just the art of problem solving writ large, right? Because it's one of the most just unique experiences, you know, in IT and in software development, is that feeling of, you know, having a concrete problem, fixing it and seeing that it actually happened. And so I spent a couple of years earlier in my career doing, you know, different technical roles, ended up leading a team of software developers and web developers and IT professionals for a company in Chicago. And then bridged from that into working inside of customer engineering here at Google, where I've been for the past 10 years. And, you know, my public sector side of the world started about 6 years ago, where I had a chance to lead our team here of customer engineers, you know, really focused then on state and local governments and how they could use different Google services to be more impactful for their constituents and really think through what are the things that we do well here at Google and how can that potentially be used more broadly inside of state and local governments here in the United States. So it's been a fun career and I certainly wouldn't trade it. So yeah, excited to get into the details.
That's awesome. And because it is Behind the Podium, we really like to dive into the backgrounds of our guests. I did see that you were a writer for a movie called Static in between your time in IT. What was that like and how did that help shape your journey in IT?
Yeah, so I took a detour in my 20s from the straight up IT and software world. And
that's a heck of a detour as well.
Yes, I zigged when I should have zagged. But really what it was it was an opportunity to work with some great friends of mine on a couple of projects. And what I found jumping into it was at first it was just, hey, let's make a short film together. And I was like, let's do it. And so I got involved in that. That was the film Static that you mentioned. And as I got involved in it, I really fell in love with just this idea of using a different side of my brain to be more creative and think about what it takes to make movies. And so especially writing screenplays became really attractive to me, which I got to take my geek side into it because it was mostly sci-fi movies that I spent the time writing.
Right. And I have like a couple questions because I really did try and find this movie. Like I really tried to watch it and I couldn't figure out. I know that it's a little bit of a horror movie as well. It's like a psycho thriller. Can you just tell like a little bit of the synopsis of the movie?
Yeah, absolutely. So Static was this idea of, you know, a woman going through her normal day and really starting to things dissolve around her a little bit because, you know, you start to realize that she is not in this idyllic life that she believes that she's in, but in fact, she's inside of this mental institution. And so it kind of flickers back and forth between the two realities for her as she kind of experiences both simultaneously. And so it was a super fun project to work through. Now, unfortunately, the reason it's so hard to find is while we were in a couple of film festivals, we also kind of predated when everything was easy to just dump onto the internet. Right. So There's not as much proof of this as there might be if I were be doing this today.
Right. Yeah. No, and that's I'm sure it was an amazing project. Are there other projects that you were really proud of that just didn't get made as well?
I mean, my baby was a film called Recursion, which, if you're a software nerd, you'll know that recursion is actually a term that we pull out of programming.
Okay.
But that was a time travel alien mashup script that it has been on the cusp of getting made probably three different times.
Really?
since we first wrote it, and loved that film, thought that it actually was a really fun and clever idea.
Yeah.
But we just never quite got it off the ground.
And so what's like the process of getting a script really off the ground? Cause I feel like this is an area that's like super interesting that a lot of people really don't really understand.
Yeah. I mean, I certainly didn't understand it, which is probably why I wasn't successful at it. But, you know, it's interesting, right? Cause it does become one of those things where you get a little bit of a catch-22 of you need to get talent attached, but talent only really wants to get attached if there's money already attached, but money doesn't really want to get attached unless there's talent attached. And so you end up in, you know, it's similar to startup world, right? Where you got to find a hook on somewhere that gets somebody excited enough to overlook what you might be missing in that process. And so, you know, that's how those things, you know, that's why connections are so important in that arena is somebody that can vouch for you to say, no, I know Chris hasn't done this before, but you can trust him. He's going to nail this one. Those same things are very, very true in screenwriting. And so, you know, there's lots of folks with brilliant ideas. It's a matter of being able to take that to fruition. And again, it's very similar to business in many ways.
Yeah, exactly. And you said it was a detour. What did you learn from that writing experience that helped you back onto the path of IT?
So much. You know, I think one of the most important things about most technical professionals' jobs that is often overlooked is the details around communication. And being a good communicator, you know, you can write code backward forward and be amazing at that part of the job. But if you can't take feedback and give feedback and elucidate what the code can and cannot do, those are things that are just table stakes to be able to be good at our professions or to be amazing at our professions, I'll say it that way. And one of the things that you learn in screenwriting is this process of making the audience understand without being pedantic. Because if you're being pedantic, it's boring. But if you are able to make it interesting as part of the script and the dialogue back and forth between two characters, that really draws the audience in. And so that has been something that I've used ever since in my career is just this idea of how do I make this interesting to all audiences? How do I put it in terms that they're going to understand without getting into technical weeds that they don't want to get into?
That absolutely makes sense. And when you think about it, your audience is mainly people who are working in the public sector directly influencing their communities. So being able to get everyone on the same page and understanding the same message is really important. I would like to pivot more towards talking to that audience because I feel like every community is lacking something that can help streamline efficiency in that community. What, in your opinion, is something that every community you've worked with currently lacks and could benefit greatly from?
You know, I think a lot of what I've seen as a pretty persistent need in the state and local communities is really an understanding and a doubling down on innovation, not just as a topic that you talk about, but actually as an institutional practice. Right. Because so often these agencies and local governments, they become mired in technology's decisions made 25 years ago. And they can't update, they can't change, they're not responsive to what the community is asking them for because they have not built that kind of foundation of we build and change things in real time, right? Like if you think about any You know, if a website looks the same as it did 15 years ago, no business survives like that.
Yeah.
But if you look at the public sector, most of their websites, if they're refreshed every 15 years, that's a pretty good pace for them. Right. And so that's, I think, the most common thing that I've seen is just this inability to institutionalize that innovation, right? Mm-hmm. Lots of them will talk about it, but it's the process of actually getting it done.
No, yeah. I think the thing that I've experienced is just the shift of QR codes as well. Like when I was waiting in line, for example, for the DMV, I could get through the pre-processing form just by scanning the QR code. But I find that there are some people who are hesitant to do that for like menus at restaurants, for example. Like they don't want to use their phone for everything, but using your phone and these little tiny like tools that you can use and plug in to make things like faster, make them a lot more efficient. I feel like that's where people are starting to get the hang of it. But then you start adding things in like generative AI and these other big technical terms that people are like, whoa, well, what is this really doing with all my data? I've seen all of these deep fakes on Twitter, et cetera, et cetera. So how do you make generative AIs, especially something that doesn't sound so scary, doesn't sound so difficult as well?
Yeah, I think the big part there is really leaning in on user-centric objectives, right? And human-centered AI is one of the kind of buzz terms in this arena. But it's not, to me, if you're ever building just to add a specific tool into a tool chain, that's where you're going to end up with something that is a flash in the pan and goes away again. But if you're building from the purpose of saying, how can I potentially make it so that, you know, my DMV experience for an individual person coming into the DMV is 10 times better than it is today? What are the things that are hard about that in today's world? Then you work backwards from that and you start to say, okay, well, you end up waiting in a long line for a long time. Oh, the documentation is really hard to figure out what you need to bring. Oh, right. This, that, and the other thing, right? And so then you start to work back from that and say, okay, well, what if there was a tool that allowed me to take a picture of my current driver's license, and from that picture, it tells me what I need to do to get it renewed, just from that picture. Mm. Like, oh, that's interesting. Mm. What tech do I need to do that? And from that, there's all sorts of things that creates and what is required from an architectural standpoint. But working backwards from that user's need means that you are going to have something that is useful over time. And then in terms of like the scariness of it, mm-hmm. Things that are useful, people are less scared of, right? It's kind of a truism of, hey, look, if I find it really useful, I don't mind that much. If, you know, I'm not going to ask too many questions about what's going on under the hood. Mm-hmm. But secondarily, it's really important to focus in on helping both the public sector entities themselves, as well as their constituents, understand what the differences are between consumer technology and enterprise technology, and how is data being respected. And then you got to follow through, right? Like if you're coming up in the news constantly for using services that have been hacked and have been phished, yeah, like that ruins trust really quickly. And so you do have to be pretty selective with your vendors and what they provide to you to make sure that you are using places that you can trust and places that you know are not the ones that are on the news constantly for having lost people's data.
Right, exactly. And that's where Google comes in, because, I mean, not to be biased, but I will say it's the one that I use. They're the most secure in my opinion, but I feel like you may be able to speak a little bit more about that than I could. But
I would say we're pretty proud of ourselves in terms of that. You know, like the biggest thing there is Google. If you think about the scale mm-hmm. of what Google has to do and what Google has to protect, right? There's over 2 billion people that use Gmail.
Right.
Like that's an insane number just to start with. Right. And so if we've seen this, nation states attempt to figure out how to get inside those Gmail right. inboxes on an hourly basis.
Yeah.
And so we have to protect to that level. Like, we have to protect against nation states attacking. Mm-hmm. And so if we're doing that, then we can externalize that same level of protection to any state that wants to use cloud services, because that cloud service is running on the same infrastructure as Gmail itself, right? And so we have that capability that's kind of built in that we extend out through our cloud services to try to keep the government as protected as Google itself is.
Yeah. And I think one of the big focuses, and just shifting back to generative AI, one of the big focuses of last year has been generative AI. And I know you're going to spend a lot of time talking about the pros and cons of applying it at a government level. But the other part of SLED is education. How is this going to affect education going forward? And how do you see it implemented?
Oh, so much. You know, I think in terms of, as you look at education, there's a couple of sides to it, right? Mm-hmm. Obviously, we're going to have to adapt how we educate in part with these new tools that are now available. You know, if you think about what these large language models are capable of, you know, there's a ton of consternation right now around cheating and students using it to write essays for them.
Right.
And it's a good conversation and it's well worth having, but it's also important to recognize that now that's going to be the tool that they use in business when mm-hmm. they graduate from educational institutions. And right. so if education is really there to try to make sure that we've got great workforce of the future, then we need to make sure that we're not running away from the tool sets that they're going to use, but figuring out how to still measure that they understand the core concepts well enough to make that possible, right? Mm-hmm. I've heard it referred to frequently as it's similar in paradigm shift to having a calculator. My 10-year-old still needs to understand fractional division and multiplication and still needs to understand the core concepts of that. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that he needs to be able to have it memorized, because that's not a useful skill anymore to have those things memorized. And so similarly, we need to teach people how to write, how to edit, without necessarily thinking about it in terms of, you know, oh, they're cheating if they use these tools, but more, how do these tools make them better writers? And so that's one aspect from an educational side. And then there's the side that's really a boon to the educators themselves. And that is to say, you know, there's an old research paper that called something the two sigma problem, which is to say students that have access to one-to-one tutoring are like two standard deviations more successful in their education than someone who does not have a private tutor.
Right.
And so what that means to us is, if generative AI gives us the capability of understanding where a learner is on their journey, what's happening with them, what is the topic area that they're struggling with, and can work them through that problem with a series of steps and by helping them in this one-to-one relationship, can we make all of our learners basically have a private tutor, right? Can higher education institutions be able to have something that gives students the ability to say, okay, I attended class and I want to go back and I want to rewatch it, but I want to rewatch and just see these highlights to be able to say, oh, I remember there was a point where the professor was teaching us about recursion. I want to make sure I understand that a little bit better. And being able to click back into that exact point and then have a summary given to me, right? These are things that generative AI does remarkably well. And so I do think that there will be these educational aspects of it that make it so that we can really reach more learners with this almost one-to-one kind of having your own, you know, Socrates sitting there teaching you philosophy one-on-one. I think mm-hmm. that's where we now are.
Yeah, I agree, because I think that this last couple of years, especially through COVID, I could not even imagine. I just got out of college COVID, but for the high schoolers who are now also just exiting out of college, maybe going into grad school now, they've known how to use like ChatGPT to do their homework and things like that. So I think that gap, yes, they're going to struggle in terms of, you know, having to use it more as a crutch. But I think now if we implement generative AI in the same sense as how you said like a calculator, but kind of more like a really, really advanced graphing calculator. You know, you didn't start using graphing calculators so you were in like, you know, pre-algebra plus. But like, it's kind of those, that same theory where if we can kind of introduce them on how to use it effectively, how it works, et cetera, and also maybe teach the ones that are more interested in, on how it works, how to even build it, how to, you know, maintain it or provide maintenance to it, et cetera, how to build off of it. I think that would be a really, really great thing to implement in high schools really early on.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, just the same as, you know, you have to be teaching kids how to be using the different technologies that are in front of us, you know, already. We have to think about this as just another technology. It's scary because it's new, but it's just another tool that we have to fold in and help them to be phenomenal at using it, or else they're going to get eclipsed by those that are phenomenal at using it.
That is all the time we have today. Chris, thank you so much for being here. This last bit is generally reserved for our guests if they want to plug anything cool that they've got coming down the road. So this time is yours.
The big thing that I'm just really excited about is this is a time and a space where I am seeing government, you know, I talked about like institutionalizing innovation, and where I'm excited is that we're actually like, I'm seeing that in pockets growing across the United States. And I think leveraging AI as a tool set that actually makes it possible to do that institutionalization is something that really unlocks what was previously too hard for most organizations to do. And so if you think about like any major problem set that's sitting before us, we shouldn't think about solving it the way that it was solved 5, 10, even 1 year ago, because the tools have changed so much.
Right.
And so we have to be able to look at these things and say, anything that really heavily impacts our constituents' lives, we should take a second look at it, figure out what this means. How could we make these things better and do it from this human-centered design? And that's really, I think, the thing that gets me all jazzed up about my work every day is that we are at this crux of being able to really deliver services in ways that are better than they've ever been done before. So I get pretty energized by it.
Honestly, I feel great hearing that, because just knowing that people who are that excited, people who are that passionate about things that just want to help people, that means a lot to me, honestly. So keep doing the great work that you're doing, Chris. I personally really appreciate it. So make sure you come see Chris at our Government IT Symposium December 13th. Chris, thank you so much for being on the show today.
Fantastic to talk with you, Jasper. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to Behind the Podium, a podcast series brought to you by Fusion Learning Partners. Visit our website, fusionlp.org, for the full lineup of podcasts and for all the exciting events we have coming up.